The following program contains graphic depictions of war and the horrors of war and may not be suitable for sensitive or younger listeners. Good afternoon and welcome to On Point. My name is Tom, and this is part two of a conversation with Vietnam veteran Roger McConnell. We continue the conversation with Roger speaking about his war experience known as Operation Emporia.
So we ended up fighting for 5 hours, and it was as intense as you can imagine with the explosions. We had tanks in our line, and they're firing what they call canister rounds, which was like a giant shotgun. The tank would shoot what they call flechette rounds. They were like a cannon round full of darts, and it would just blow a hole in any kind of underbrush and blow giant holes in anybody trying to assault you. Those things were lethal. The sound... The combat is beyond belief. Your adrenaline level is through the roof. You're petrified. This was the first time I'd been under fire, and it is such a bizarre feeling because you are so terrified that everything seems to be going a million miles an hour. And the sounds, the smells of the cordite and the ammunition as you're firing it, and just the fear in all of your comrades' eyes, it's just beyond comprehension. But I remember, and I had seen these old James Bond books about how James Bond would talk about being able to measure everything minutely when he was in the heat of battle, and how his mind was just going 1,000 miles an hour, and how he was so calm inside the eye of the hurricane. And that happened. The panic that you were experiencing right at first, it just slipped away when you got inside the eye of this, and that when it was just so calm thereafter that you could do the things you needed to do to survive, and just kind of on autopilot. And you did have everything measured. It was incredible to feel that plugged in.
You had said that the elite car, the first car, had been in combat for maybe 45 minutes before you were ordered to go up there.
That was the first element of probably, I'm going to guess, probably 30 armored personnel carriers and long trucks containing these Rome plows, these huge bulldozers.
Right.
And there were some MPs that were up front, too. And luckily, none of those MPs got killed. In that lead personnel carrier, and once again, they're also called tracks or ACAVs.
Yeah.
That vehicle contained my best friend and the captain, the commander of L Troop, and two other men. And then behind that vehicle sat my counterpart, the FO track of friends that I had in the 11th Armored Cavalry, and they were second. Well, everybody except one person in those first two lead vehicles in the initial part of the ambush was killed. My friend and the captain of L Troop and everybody on the FO track, they called it, the FO vehicle, forward observer, was killed except for the forward observer. He was able to escape into the bushes there somehow and avoided getting killed.
So you did make it to the first unit?
No, we never did. They had either relocated the ambush backwards a ways, or they had set up an additional force to counteract our surge to try to help L Troop. because we never got there. We then ended up in a new ambush, and they killed everybody in the track in front of me except the commander of that track, who was blinded by an RPG hit. And I didn't see him that day. He, like so many other wounded combatants, flew to Japan probably, or maybe even straight home. And you just never heard if they made it or not. They just kind of got sucked up by the system, and all I know is everybody else was killed on that vehicle.
One can only imagine the horror of something like that. I mean, bullets going off in the air. You're probably hearing men screaming. Could you see your enemy at any time? I mean, how are you fighting the enemy?
Well, initially, during the first stage of the ambush that we were involved in, I just saw the automatic weapon fire coming out of the trees right beside the road. And I mean, right beside the road. We later found bodies of people that we had killed in the trees. They had tied themselves up in these rubber trees right beside the road. They had automatic weapons and these RPGs, which were the lethal killers of American armor. They would penetrate these personnel carriers, and especially the gasoline versions of those M113s, just turn them into Roman candles and kill everybody in the track when these things would explode through the sides. The automatic weapon fire was so close, proximally, to the side of the road that at one point later in the fight, I had to stand up to unjam this 50 caliber machine gun, had to stand up in this shield to try to get some leverage on this handle to extract this round. And it's the strangest feeling in the world to expose yourself to machine gun fire where I had no idea where these guns were located. I just knew they were close, but it was something that had to be done. And you just reached down inside and you said, well, here I go. Stood up and kept expecting my head to blow off my shoulders, and it didn't.
You had mentioned to me there was one time where you knew you were going to die in Vietnam, and there was one time where you thought you were going to die in Vietnam. Was that one of the times?
Well, this was so nasty, I didn't see how we could get out of it. And that's probably what saved my life, is before I got into the eye of the storm that we talked about earlier. It was just obvious. We're in the kill zone of this ambush. All three of our belt-fed automatic weapons jammed. All three. We were all kind of hidden down under the lip of this personnel carrier, and this battle's raging all around us. I remember looking into the eyes of everybody around me thinking, well, who's going to do something? And there was nobody home in any of these eyes. It was nothing but absolute terror. So it was like, well, it looked like it had to be me. So at that particular point, you just do what you have to do. And that's when I figured, I'm dead. So you do what warriors have done forever. You just try to take as many of them with you as you can on the way out. So I'd just written it off. I knew I was going to die. And that's no exaggeration. That's just the way it felt, because when you don't have your belt-fed automatic weapons, I'm shooting with an M16 over the top of this personnel carrier, not knowing where any of these people are. They know exactly where we are. And I guess we were just somehow in the right place of that column so that maybe they had, I don't know.
I mean, who's to say? I mean, it's just such
the chaos.
A chance. I mean, just, you know, being 1 foot over or, you know, 5 feet back, who has control over that?
I've thought a lot looking at it from their perspective at here, this invading American army, and they see all these kids on these vehicles. And I often wonder how many people had me in their sights that day, because I was jumping around on this track trying to get these weapons unjammed and trying to put up a little bit of a defense so they wouldn't just walk over to the vehicle and throw a grenade in it. We must have been lucky enough that they either didn't have enough of this RPG ammunition, because it was like a bazooka of the old World War II era. They would load a rocket into this tube. They still have them today. It's an incredible weapon. They're fighting these RPGs in Afghanistan today. And it launches this grenade up to 300 meters. It's fairly accurate. Shoots it on a, it's like a rocket. It shoots it on a straight line. And it'll burn through the outside of an armored vehicle and then blow up. And it just cuts people to shreds that are behind that barrier of that 2-inch aluminum armor of those personnel carriers, or however thick it was. But it was just like the porous piece of cheese that these things would go through to get us.
So the fight lasted about 4 or 5 hours. What are you going through for 4 or 5 hours? Constant firing?
And trying to unjam these weapons. Exactly. Wow. The weapons. I had never cleaned a 50 caliber machine gun before that particular operation. Somebody else cleaned all these weapons on this vehicle, and they miscleaned them because they didn't put this 50 caliber back together correctly. And it almost killed us all. Had they had more men right there at the point, we would have been dead. For whatever reason, it just worked out that we didn't get dead.
How did the combat end? Were airstrikes called in, or?
Yeah, we had a lot of airstrikes, and that was probably the turning point. When these guys roll in with napalm and with 20-millimeter cannons, they can send those guys on their way if they know what's good for them. So at some point, I'm sure they broke off the ambush. And who knows how long afterwards we kept shooting, because you're shooting at ghosts anyhow. I have no idea. All of a sudden, I know they're on the radio that everything's clear, and we start hauling bodies to helicopters, and that was a strange day.
So that was your first major battle in Vietnam for you. You knew what it was about, what war was about.
Well, yeah. Everybody's war is different. Infantrymen, sometimes they would get into contact and it would be light fire, and it wouldn't have been as intense as this. But then again, maybe not. I think it's pretty intense anytime you think you might die. And the gunfire and all the shouting and chaos just adds to the terror of the moment. And until you've been there, there's no way to convey that feeling of the event to anybody who's not experienced it themselves.
I know, and it's just amazing when you think about our society and how, I don't want to say we're raised or brought up, but it's very competitive nature. And with all your gaming devices and you're going to war on your gaming devices, they almost glorify it. These guys want to go into war, and they're all big, strong guys. And they got their M16, and that's a game.
So that's a game. And you don't know how ugly people die until you see the pieces of people
And the smell.
Oh, the smell of burning flesh. The second position vehicle, the FO track, with L Troop, which was right behind the commanding officer at the very point of the ambush, they took an RPG hit and burned up. And the next day, after the fight, we had towed the vehicle to our logger area. That vehicle burnt all night, and the driver was still in the driver's hatch. Dead, of course. He had burnt to a crisp. They asked me and two other men to try to lift him out of that hatch, which was really tightly confined. But I remember going in there and trying to lift his charred body. His body was just covered with ashes. He was still sitting up directly, pretty upright in this driver's seat. He had just burnt up that way and had somehow frozen in that upright position, not even leaning against the sides. It was freaky to go down in there and see his body in that position, like he was ready to take off again, you know. But I tried to lift him out of there, and my fingers went right through the ash that was covering his body and into this milky, pasty-like, gooey stuff that just came all over my fingers. And it was kind of crazy when you knew this guy and you're trying to get him out of there to send him home and to have him just come apart in your hands. It was bizarre, to say the least.
We had talked earlier and you said the Vietnam had a way of just, it looked like they were smiling almost or laughing at you. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
After this ambush, we were right on, well, it was a gravel road, but it was one of the main thoroughfares in Vietnam. And naturally, there was a lot of civilian traffic that wanted to go through this ambush area. And there were still personnel carriers burning and a lot of wreckage on the road from explosions, vehicles blowing, partially blowing up, these RPGs taking parts off of them. And so this civilian traffic was being directed by MPs through the wreckage and through these burning vehicles and through the smell of this guy and other guys who had burned up in these vehicles. And it smelled awful. Burning flesh is just something you'll never forget the smell of. But so as these civilians are going through there in their trucks and buses, a lot of public transportation, I remember a whole bus full of people, and they, that oriental countenance or visage or whatever it's called, they tried to put masks, bandanas over their faces so that they didn't have to smell or inhale all this ash and all this smoke in the air. So all you could see was their eyes, and it did look like they were laughing at us. And look, here you had just picked up your friends and shipped them into helicopters and to go to graves registration, and you were flaming, you know. We were so crazy at the time after fighting this thing for 6 hours and knowing that ultimately we found out that 15 of us had gotten killed and just the lead elements of these two ambushes. And you were just livid. And it was, I remember sitting there and looking at my friends' faces and how they were all feeling the same thing. And the hatred, we were directing it all toward these civilians that we thought were laughing at us. And it was a real tinderbox situation. I remember thinking that just one little spark, if somebody had moved the wrong way or something, there would have been a busload of dead Vietnamese there. And we probably would have been court-martialed or on trial for murder or something. But that's what happens in wartime. Things like that. That's what happened in My Lai. That's what happened all over the place. That were civilian people were in the wrong place at the wrong time and encountered some very angry troops, and they lost their lives a lot of times.
So your tour is 365 days. How long have you been in Vietnam when this particular incident happened?
Well, that was July 21st of 1967. I had 4 months and 9 days to go on my tour. So I was there, including my boat ride, just almost 8 months.
Good afternoon. My name is Tom Halverson, and we're here visiting with Roger McConnell. On Point, Vets for Vets. We've kind of turned the tables here. Roger usually does the hosting of the show, but we decided to talk about Roger's story, his Vietnam story. So now, this fight has been over. How was the rest experience of Vietnam? Was it as intense? Could you make sense out of it? How are you feeling at this point? Ready to go home?
Oh, that's a tough question. It's... maybe you get a little harder with every incident, every combat incident. I'd been friends with the Vietnamese kids who would come into our base camp before this mission, and I felt a change, and I remember feeling not necessarily a hatred of them, but just an anger at them. We had gone through a village right before that ambush, and we kind of blamed the villagers for not keying us that they were setting up this ambush, and some of the people in the fight might have been villagers. We, after the battle, we found 33 dead Viet Cong. The Stars and Stripes newspaper credited us with killing like 180. So that tells you a little bit about body counts. We found 33, or we had to assemble some bodies from parts of bodies because they were just blown into pieces, some of them. We were so mad at this village, and we thought that some of these people may have inhabited this village, that we drove back through the village and kicked all these bodies off into the village, 33 bodies.
And what was the response? Were they hiding from you, or were they, did it get the response that you wanted, or?
Well, I don't even remember seeing too many villagers. They knew we'd gotten our butts kicked in this ambush.
You guys were so angry, though.
Oh, you just angry beyond words, it was so volatile. So we just left a calling card, if you will, with the villagers and maybe some relatives of the people we'd killed. Viet Cong they were like a National Guard unit, let's say. They were made up of the public in most cases that were night fighters, barbers by day and killers by night.
So here you are, a young man, 21, never experienced a war before in your life. You go off to a whole completely different country, experience pretty much what most people would consider hell for 12 months. Now you're coming back home. You've had all these experiences. You're full of a lot of anger, probably a lot of questions. I mean, how do you deal with that? How was your homecoming? Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
So many of the soldiers in that era, because of the hippie movement and the anti-war movement, came home to airports full of angry protesters who spit on them and abused them in lots of different ways. I didn't have that happen to me. I was a little bit ahead of the curve on that one, came home before a lot of that really started off. But it was just in the early stages. But I stuck my thumb out at LAX, LA International Airport, and hitchhiked home, and not knowing how I was going to do it. I had a huge duffel bag, and I just thought I would surprise my folks. And so I stuck out my thumb. The first guy that picks me up, LA, I don't know if you've ever driven in LA traffic, but going 5 miles out of your way is a big favor. This guy took me 40 miles out of his way to deliver me to my front porch, and
made you feel good.
Oh, wow. That was a nice homecoming. He didn't have to do that, but mm-hmm. he did. And,
so here you are back in the United States. Are you thinking about working? Are you thinking, I'm just glad to be out of that war? All of the above. Are you want to spend time with your mom and your dad? I mean, where are you at this point in your life?
Well, I'd been married, but that didn't last long after my wife decided to entertain all the troops at home. So so that no longer was a good scene. I remember they held my job for me. I was working at a public utility, Southern Counties Gas Company in Southern California, and they saved my job for me, but I didn't go back until I absolutely had to. It's like, it was just such a shock to the system to go through that. And then the one of the things I remember very vividly was I had been in country walking through jungle. We got to the point where we turned into like a mechanized infantry unit. And I'm walking through jungle with only 3 days left in country of my tour. You're getting real shaky that short, that close to rotation. And then I got on a plane, came home, and we ended up in Oakland, where they out-processed us, took them 40 hours. Then they just turned us loose. and we have to make our own travel arrangements to get to where we're going. But a friend of mine, a door gunner on my personnel carrier, he and I end up going down to Haight-Ashbury district in San Francisco. And talk about culture shock and a twilight zone to come out of an area where you're walking around with an M16 thinking you're going to step on something and blow your legs off, or just all the fears of that existed in a combat area. And all of a sudden I'm walking around in the ultimate freak show of all of these long hair whack jobs, or so I thought back in that era when, I'm pretty straight-laced. It was unbelievable culture shock, first class, but we didn't get attacked or anything. I don't remember. We were probably, I'm surprised that happened a lot of times, because the soldiers, after you've been in combat, you come home, you got a different look about you. I'm surprised so many people got attacked, because they had to know that you had crossed so many lines that they'd never even been confronted with in terms of having to kill people. Maybe we scared a few people away and Haight-Ashbury. They didn't want to go there. Yeah.
And probably at this particular point, I mean, you're coming back, you're pretty confident about your fighting ability, and you're not going to take a lot of crap from somebody that maybe wasn't there, doesn't understand what you've gone through.
Well, that happened later in my life at different junctures where I did get jumped or whatever. And it's crazy, the zone you go into. And, all that stuff just becomes automatic. Mm-hmm. And you just try to do what you can to survive. And it usually makes a waste of somebody else, you know.
You hear about all of the help that our returning troops are receiving now, coming back from both Iraq and Afghanistan. How was it for you?
There was nothing.
And then it was welcome back to the United States.
Yeah, welcome back to the U.S.
Could you tell, were things bothering you? Were you having flashbacks or bouts of, aggression, or just being aggravated with things?
All I remember seeing, going out to dinner with some friends from high school who hadn't gotten drafted, and we went to a place with a seemingly nice young man who my age, who was a hippie with long hair, and I remember getting goofy and wanting to get my hands around his throat or mm-hmm. something, because he just represented a lot of the non-support that we felt while we were over there. And it wasn't his fault, and he seemed like a nice kid, and he couldn't understand why I was going off. But it was just the way it was. And things, so many triggers that it took me years to understand, that all of a sudden you're just furious at somebody or something. And
maybe for not even a really good reason.
That wasn't a good reason to get crazy at that kid. I didn't hit him or anything, but I just got goofy.
Well, you hear about some of our veterans have been treated, like Diane Carlson Evans when she came back. Mm-hmm. Actually, somebody was waiting at the airport. There was a group of guys or something that were talking down to him.
Well, that was a year and a half later, and mm-hmm. and it got much goofier. I've heard so many stories of people being attacked and spit on and all that, and some of them didn't take it. Some hippie protesters got hurt. I don't know. I think they deserved it to try and attack the messengers instead of the anti-war movement.
I guess we're coming to the point where we're going to wrap up the show. I'm just wondering if there's anything else that you want to say about your experience or about war itself. What is maybe your biggest lesson or something that really has come out of this that maybe was positive even?
Well, a lot's come out of it that was positive. But it took me years to understand it, because the thing that strikes me the deepest is that the experience itself was such an affront and such a soul-deep wound to your being that you can't help but be dramatically affected and dramatically changed by that experience. It took me a while to see it in all of its different faces. There for a while, I was fine, and then I just kind of entered this downward spiral of alcohol and other sedatives and other things to try to just put the nightmares to bed and to try and live through it, you know. And I didn't even know what I was living through. I thought I was home, I was safe, everything was fine. But there was this boogeyman that inside me that would just keep rearing its head and making me do these things. And I thought I was just stone crazy. I thought nobody had ever experienced this. And nobody else on the planet knew what it was like. And I was totally alone in that feeling. And then a gentleman in a bar came up to me one night. This is 15 years after the event. I'd been a spook for 10 of those years of just walking around alone, hitchhiking or everywhere, essentially homeless, and just not being a part of anything, just anti-everything, anti-everybody. And this guy meets me in this bar, and he comes up to me, and he says, "You were there." And I'm thinking, I wasn't anywhere, friend. I don't want to fight. But he says, "You were there, too." And he says, "You were in Vietnam." And I said, "Well, how do you know?" He said, "I just knew." And he sat me down, and he told me what my life had been like for the past 15 years, about all the different jobs, all the different bouts of alcohol, all the different car crashes, all the different troubles. For the first time since I had started to auger in after that experience, I understood that there were other people that felt the same thing. So I guess the message I'm trying to deliver is that there's going to be a whole lot of people from Iraq and Afghanistan that come home, and it might take them a while. Took me several years before the effects hit me full on. But you're not alone. It's natural to feel what you're feeling. And the good news is that with work and with help and with other people's compassion, your family members and your the VA is turning into a great help. But help is there. And there is a road of recovery, and you can climb on it with the rest of us.
And I think you brought up a really good point. You're not alone. You're not the only one that went through that experience. And I think once you realize that and maybe start talking to some other veterans, maybe that kind of gets you on the road to recovery or to help with recovery. Not an easy process, especially considering what you've gone through. Well, I think we'll wrap this up with just saying it's a pleasure speaking with you, and thanks for sharing your story sincerely.
You're welcome, Tom. Thank you.
My name's Tom Halverson, On Point Vets for Vets. We've been speaking with Roger McConnell from the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. Thank you for being on Point.
You're welcome. On Point continues to air every other Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Montana Public Radio, KGPR, Great Falls. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future shows, please contact me, Roger McConnell, at 406-799-6709 or an email onpointkgpr@bresnan.net.